Sukhina.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, I'm your host, Dr. Vijay Murthy. Welcome back, Maya. Maya is a humanitarian, a world-renowned health educator who has changed the lives of thousands of women. Those listeners who listened to her very first episode will have recognized the way how Maya's life changed from being a successful fashion designer to then being diagnosed with a very challenging disease condition, ovarian cancer, in the 1970s. After that, for 40 years, she has found ways to heal, not just for herself, but also to show how to heal for everyone around her. And I'm so grateful, Maya, for continuing to share your wisdom and your experience. In the last episode, you mentioned a very important thing, which is cancer can be a transformer. And that transformation then, in your case, took the form of listening to your inner voice. You went into the woods in Vermont, you lived in the cabin, and then you actually embrace nature and made that your lifestyle. And that pause that you took was the most important step. But then you discovered inner medicine. You have started the very first school on Ayurveda, which mainly taught people to use food as medicine. And you are a pioneer in health education through Ayurveda by starting the very first Ayurveda school in North America in 1981. And then you have started Mother O Mission, Mom. What a fantastic name. You started that on Mother's Day in 1998, supporting and helping people who are underprivileged. So you have done some amazing job by not only looking after yourself in a very difficult situation like cancer, but that has transformed the world around you. Today we are going to be looking at food as medicine. So there's going to be a lot of practical tips in our episode today. And Maya, thank you so much. Tell me something that you call food as medicine. Why is that?
From time immemorial, thousands and thousands of centuries ago, the tender of this land from all of our native traditions, and all of us are native because we did get sourced in that native birth from the land, food has been looked at as medicine. Hippocrates has said it, Einstein has said it, Goethe has said it, Ibsen has said it, Shakespeare kind of said it, and of course Ayurveda and all of our Vedic seers, Annam Aushadam Asti, food is medicine.
Is that because there was no medicine then?
It was because we didn't compartmentalize life into the breakdown of nutrition, the protein, the carbohydrates, the amino acids, the various enzymatic contents, etc., etc. Once we began to fragmentize life, which, you know, the scientific researchers started to do, is we took apart the rasa, the taste, the absolute value of the food, and started to plunk back in what we thought would better nature. That was our primordial first mistake of humanity in terms of food. We have an incredible, intelligent nature, Mother Nature, who provides us with millions of dollars of food for free and gifts that are known and unknown. Her seasons, eating with her seasons, eating within the climate patterns that we are in, whether it's a temperate zone, tropical zone, whatever, the zone areas, understanding our relationship between the vital tissue and that food. These are all principles that Ayurveda has put forth so well. Ayurveda, as many people know, now, because it is a sister science to yoga, came from India, and it is thousands and thousands and thousands of years old and ancient. And principles that are perennial, that have survived the shackles of time, so to speak, those principles that we're using today still depend on our climate, our environment, the state of our earth, the seasons, the changes, and the unpredictable. We have had many more unpredictable seasons now than in the past because of the damage we've done to climate and other things. But to put it simply, Vijay, for instance, the first thing I did after leaving that cabin and was given the life sentence that now you don't anymore have that sentence, how you have to live your life, was to go back and reunite with my family in Canada. They were there at the time. I was bald, 90 pounds, and absolutely bald from chemotherapy and 90 pounds, and probably a sight to behold by my parents. But after the reunion, I came back and delved into first Oriental medicine, the study of it. I needed to understand what exactly happened there in my survival. And then I went on to the motherland of India for the first time and began to study Vedas and Ayurveda. What I noticed happened for me was that I took a liking to grains. I bought my first pressure cooker, and started to cook brung rice. Loved brung rice, especially in the winter. And then I found millet, which is, of course, native to Africa, native to India, native to the Incas. Later we have quinoa that came into America, but in fact it has been thousands and thousands of years old. I'm told, by the way, in Ayurveda, the smaller the grain or the legume, the more potent it is in terms of its ancient ancestry.
So what I'm hearing here is, you know, I'm here in 2016. I practice nutrition myself, and I also help people who need help with nutrition. But what I'm hearing from you is you have a different concept of nutrition to what a lot of us might currently think about. We think about macronutrients, micronutrients, the minerals, the phytoconstituents and antioxidants, adaptogens. You know, a lot of these terms may not be familiar to all the listeners, but, you know, this is the lingo of our modern approach to nutrition and health. But in your situation, what really catches my attention, Maya, is that, yes, you had chemotherapy, 16 surgeries, and then radiation. There was adverse effects of radiation, then it metastasized, and then you went into your retreat where you started embracing nature, and then you have changed the way you look at food, the way you eat food, the way you prepare food, and you call it food as medicine, inner medicine. And then, unlike many other women who would have undergone hysterectomy or not, or radical hysterectomy, still would experience hot flashes and many other, you know, signs and symptoms that come with the perimenopause and postmenopause, and they would need hormone replacement therapy, or they might choose hormone replacement therapy. But in my conversations with you, you have always told you never had those experiences. My guess, as a practitioner and a researcher, is it the way you ate which may have had an effect on how you actually became so super healthy?
Absolutely. I went back, first of all, to the ancestral ground and reclaimed the natural foods of nature in her right cycle. Not so much importation. We can have something imported from other cultures and whatever. That's not a problem. But the main part of our diet must subsist from the environment we're living in and the season within which we live. Nature knows what to provide us for which dhatu or tissue. She knows
so
what to provide us.
Dhatu is
the vital tissue.
So it's the
and for
Ayurvedic
which
term.
Ayurveda term is, and for which dosha, which is your metabolic constitution in Ayurveda.
So metabolic constitution is called dosha.
Yes.
So can I just kind of summarize that?
Please do.
In Ayurveda, the body is seen through the lens of three bioenergetic forces, which are based on the classical elements, air, And space is called vata.
Vata.
And fire and water is called pitta. Generally, we call a fiery body type. And water and earth is called kapha. And obviously, based on the metabolic type, a vata person may have difficulty gaining weight, whilst a kapha person may have difficulty losing weight. A pitta person may easily gain weight or lose weight. This is just one example. So basically, it's about understanding your body type. Is that what you did, is to understand your own body type from an Ayurvedic perspective?
Yes, as I got to the first, my experience, the experience of going right back to the earth, using instead of the refined grain, I would use the brung rice, short grain in the winter, long grain in the spring, and like that, and something lighter like millet in the summer, and began to be really invested. I found with the grains, I firmly believe that my hormonal balance adjusted themselves because of the value in the grains. And because I spent endless years, I didn't feel fed and nourished unless I had at least one grain a day in my meal.
So what were you eating before?
Well, when I was up to 16 in Guyana, my father was very, very strict about our diet in terms of it being from nature. We had endless numbers of choices because in the tropical land, food grows a long, long time throughout the year and barely stops, but changes from, seasonally in a very subtle way. And also, he made sure, even though white rice and wheat flour, wheat did not grow in Guyana, but it was imported from India, he made sure that we had the rice flour to make our chapatis and breads with, a lot more than we use the wheat, which did not grow locally, and also had the rice mills give us brown rice instead of just white rice. So he was a firm believer of living off the land in an intelligent way, and that early was really the early education for me. When I came to New York and I was de-victimizing the psyche in so many ways, what ended up happening is, we have social lives, we have parties where we would eat food that is brought in from all over the world, considered gourmet and expensive, and the best restaurants to eat in and all of that. And I was caught in that as well. And occasionally, if you're celebrating your 100th wedding anniversary, it's understandable that you would want to make the stride out there and have some gourmet food. But what sustains our health is our garden. We'll talk later about how we got to picking up concrete from the inner cities of New York and teaching people how to put their herbs in the front yard. And that was through the mission in the inner cities of New York. But getting back to me, I went back to grains, but had many more grains in America than we did in Guyana. We had millet and quinoa and buckwheat, which is kasha as well. And I just fell in love with grains and legumes, the lentils and mung, and just, in Ayurveda, we make an incredible khichdi. It's a one-pot deal. Simple, the rice, and we can use the long grain basmati, or we can use the millet.
You can use brown rice?
Or we can use brown rice, but we have to marry the rice carefully with the bean. It's just like compatibility in couples. You don't want the chickpea to be married to the white rice, to the white basmati rice, because it will never work. The chickpea takes a long time to cook, The white rice is cooked within a few minutes. So basically, khichdi really means putting the marriage of bean and grain in an intelligent way. And when you look at the grain that marries the bean, not only the same size, but in fact, it's also guided by the same seasons in terms of how we use it. So that became my meal for quite a long time. But there's so much variety in grain and beans that you can make any number of khichdi. And then I would just steam the kale leaves or the broccolini, or the English peas, or some of my more favorite vegetables. I would see. I love purple kale, by the way. We have so many varieties of kale, and so many organic farmers now that are bringing in all the heritage seeds back, and we can have incredible variety. There's nothing more beautiful than a simple pot meal. That alone, if we're feeling ill at ease, not well, beginning to be stressed, we just stay with that as sort of a way of fulfilling our need for nourishment, at the same time lessening and lightening as well. Now, as we know, the different constitution have different choices. Obviously, if we are a Pitta type, which is a very fiery type, not only mentally but physiologically, the skin looks reddish or yellowish, aquiline, you know, nose, very fine features and very athletic in their way.
They tend to lose hair very quickly, or premature graying of their hair, or they feel hungry. Often they can't miss a meal. They get angry if they miss a meal. So all these are Pitta characteristics.
Those are all characteristics, except we don't want to scare our Pitta types right off the bat by telling them.
No, but they're very sharp, very analytical. They're very determined. They're the kind of people who are very determined to follow nutrition and exercise program. They're very, very organized.
They're very dedicated and organized. Yeah. Absolutely. But they're not going to want to have just red peppers for lunch and fiery foods and spicy, oily, greasy foods, because that's going to increase the Pitta, douse the digestive fire and create problems. And if we have the Vata type, which is very air and space are their main components, we need to make sure that they're not using dried foods like leftover foods or millet, which can be a little dried, and need to put more water and make it soft. And also,
because those who have a Vata constitution, they tend to have kind of fluctuating digestive system. So they are sensitive to a food one day, and another day, when they are in a good mood or good environment, the same food is perfectly fine with them. So it becomes so confusing for Vata people to actually understand whether they are sensitive to certain foods or not, because the reaction of the body is different. That's the nature of Vata, air. And they are a bit sensitive as well because of their digestive system. They have a tendency towards constipation. And also, they jump from one idea to the next. Like, they are following this diet today, and the next day they want some other diet.
But what is good about air types as well, and this is why we can't, you know, Pitta types tend to also create the fads in food, and we'll get to that later.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Creating fads, meaning that food becomes a movement, and we are going to now bring our own teas to the dinner that we're going to our mother-in-law place with tonight and whatever. I mean, it becomes a little bit difficult to deal with life if we're going to have a movement where we become allergic to life. So what I suggest is that we cannot afford to have food as a fad. That's commercial. And the breakdown, the disintegration of the memory of the food. Nature knows what memory the food is, in which organ it's going to serve, and which body type it's going to serve. She's been doing this for millennia, from the eons, the beginning of time. And therefore, when we start breaking down the food, we're also, that became a fad, that became a movement, because it fed the pocketbooks of commercial organizations who go after making money out of food. Now, the farmers deserve to make a good price for their produce. They work very hard. We're not saying that we should undercut anyone's payment here. But when we talk about food as a movement, that's an entirely different topic. But right now, I'd love to get back to some of the simple things that work, so that our listener understand how simple it is to make that shift.
So can we do this, Maya? Like, for instance, if there were two people with a similar condition, and they come to you, and I know you have helped thousands and thousands and thousands of women and thousands of men. When they come to you, you know, say for instance, somebody like me who's living in London, who's not close to the farm, who can't have a garden, and they come to you, what changes would you suggest to them in terms of how they can become aware of what they're eating? What should they be eating? How do they embrace food as medicine from your perspective?
Yes. For me, it was very simple. I understood that nature had cured me in so many ways, and I was going to look into explore her nature of her foods. I understood that to be inner medicine from the first get-go. But a year after surviving cancer, I saw I had put back on my weight. I was then 120 pounds instead of 90 pounds. My hair grew back abundantly. I mean, it was absolutely more beautiful than before. The skin was clear and translucent because it had been a year since I was eating a whole grain, making sure I had some legumes in it and or separately from it, lots of food from my own garden, which I became a voracious gardener, and grew the things. But I traveled a lot in my work as well. So then the first thing I would do when I get to a city is find out where is the farmer's market or the organic food store and make my trip there en route from the airport so that I had. And I also created, I mean, this is not going to ask people to do this, but I created a little travel pack store so that I can utilize every hotel room as my own little kitchenette. And it was very simple. It was a little pot, and unfortunately you plugged it in. I don't love electrical energy for cooking, but it is better than nothing if you...
You can't have open fire in a hotel, I'm sorry.
No, I understand that. And, I'm not going to talk about hiding the smoke detectors and stuff like that, but when you have a little pot that you plug in, it's very simple, you know, because they have plug-in kettles and whatever in hotels.
Yes, so, to make tea, yeah.
To make tea. But my little plug-in pot was tiny, and it carried my little pre-mixed khichdi package, which had the basmati, sometimes the white. The white is easy for digestion, so if you're having a digestive problem, you can use it, because it uses less of the agni or digestive fire. And the split mung.
So agni is a term that you use for digestifier.
The split mung and cumin seed, some turmeric already mixed in, a little bit of Himalayan rock salt, or you can use Celtic sea salt, or any of the unrefined sea salts are good. And then pre-mixed. And so all I did was opened it and put it in. And en route I would buy my water and then use the water and make my... It took 10 minutes to make, and I had a scrumptious meal. But the other thing is, but we have homes and we have kitchens. So changing breakfast, for instance, from a huge plethora of things that we eat, how wonderful. Even if you're doing oats in the morning, it's fine with whichever milk. If you're allergic to cow's milk, then we have almond milk, we have soya milk, we have rice milk, we have coconut milk, any of the milks that we like, but definitely not a commercial cow milk that is out because of the hormones and the poisons put into it, the artillery of drugs put into the poor cows. Anyway, getting back to that, then we can make our cereal with some whole oats and that and raisins inside of it. What I love to do actually is chia seeds remember when they used to grow those little chia plants from the chia seeds? I mean, it was the first introduction of chia seeds in America. But now, you know, science does have some contribution to finding out good things. My objection is not with science, but it's the way it breaks things down and then make it commercial in the industry where we take the nutrient out of the food and plunk back something else into it to refortify. There's no such thing as refortification in it. We're just destroying the basic element of the food. So we can't refortify it with our mind. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. It leaves so much to be desired. But one,
I have a term for my denaturing food. Mm-hmm. I call it, it's like making food go through sex change.
Mm.
Completely change its nature by taking gluten out of it, calling it non-gluten. I mean, what I'm really hearing is that it's very important to see food as food, not as what is sold as food.
Absolutely. Having been celibate for more than 50 years of my life, I wouldn't know about the sex change. However, we can get back to this incredible understanding of the food is whole. And after a while, we break it down into such misery that we can never plunk it back, put it back together. So the chia seeds are so wonderful. If you like a breakfast that is more like a tapioca pudding, which I love that consistency because I have so much kapha in me, that water element, you just make it in lukewarm water, but keep stirring it so it doesn't become glops. And then put in your raisins or dates, you know, for pitta or vata or kapha. All of it's so wonderful for
everyone. Isn't it too sugary?
Dates. Dates is natural. It's a natural sugar of the natural date. And it's totally sweet. It is extremely sweet, but it's not sugary. It doesn't have this. It doesn't break down in the same way. Nature's fruits, when they're dried, are intended to provide that sweetness. We must have some sweetness in life, especially today when our universe is in such conflict and there's so much strife, and in each person's life they're mirroring more unhappiness and a lack of being grounded. We need that breakfast to
So you're not talking about refined sugars, you're talking about natural sugars as they can be found in nature in limited quantities.
In limited quantity,
not binging.
Sugar. Yeah, we had, for instance, something called sucanat years back that was developed, which is from the sugar cane, but made in such a way that it was so divine, and of course the maple sugars. But now we have the coconut sugars because coconut has become so extremely popular. But what I'd like to caution our audience about with the popularity of coconut. Coconut has been around for millions of years, and all of a sudden it becomes a fad. And then everything is coconut. And then all the packages are coconut packages. And then packages of this and packages of that. And poor coconut. I mean, what has ever happened to the coconut? You know, how are we going to replicate that fresh coconut milk in all these millions and millions of boxes of supposedly fresh coconut milk? So what we need to understand is that's what we're talking about when food becomes a fad, and when the commercial industry becomes fat from that fad, and human being just becomes sort of tunneled into this vision of, I have to get now coconut milk, first I have to get the antioxidant, then I have to get the coconut milk, then I have to go, and you know, every year something else is becoming a fad. All of a sudden, safflower oil now, 3,000 whatever, becomes the weight loss thing, and at one point, safflower oil was the rapeseed oil, was it not? Which we couldn't use because it had toxic elements in it. And now all of a sudden, it's become the gold seal of, oh, that oil can make you lose weight. Once upon a time, there was the whole cholesterol heart thing, as you know, as a doctor, that where you couldn't have coconut oil because it was too fatty and da-da-da-da. And you couldn't have a ghee, which is the clarified butter made from organic, because basically that will add fat into the tissue and then you'll have a heart condition. But now we understand that that is not so at all.
But, you know, my question really is, you know, I have gone through this whole, I have probably done every type of diet myself because I like to explore and understand. But I'm sure a lot of the listeners would be in a similar situation. How do we stay away from these fads and dogma about nutrition to actually make food our medicine?
The big word here is fear. So many of our people, our beautiful people, are searching for health, but they are not looking for health in the way that will make them healthy. They're responding to the fear of disease. There is a difference when we invest in the land and nature and the farmer and the good food and Mother Earth, rather than when we pursue an industry that is commercially catering to us and leading us into our fears and then exploding our fears into mega trillion dollars. This, I don't want to get political here, but we need to understand that food for one must be food for all. When we come from that humanitarian principle that is self-love, the love that expands to my neighbor, to my people, whatever characteristics they may have, it doesn't matter. If we can look at, if I eat something, I pray that it heals not only myself, but someone around me, my family, or the neighbors who really need help, or the community who's just had a huge attack of nature and are homeless. If we reroute, just shift, a little shift in our consciousness can change our reason for going after the health food. As long as we go after it from a fear of illnesses and disease and despair, we will never make the mark of becoming healthy, because fear has a way to counteract health and make money for an entire industry. We have invested and we are making trillions of dollars in profit in the United States alone from health food stores, and not a single poor person has been fed from that. So there is a problem with the way we are going into what we considered holistic and healthy. Healthy is understanding our nature to be Mother Nature's nature, protecting her, therefore getting protected. Therefore, when we simplify our lives a bit, and I'm not saying that we have to completely throw out everything as I did and then simplify it immediately. I was retracting back to my ancestral ground, and it was a little bit easier for me to remember. But many of us have been severed from it for a very, very long time, other than just a decade. And for those of us, I say, please look into how you can simplify that food. Don't be so overstressed with organic. If the farmer next door is planting it and he's not spraying it, it's organic enough for you. And by the way, if we completely go and become all 100% totally organic, which there is no such thing, by the way, because I remember in my wonderful organic gardens at the school at Weisert School in Asheville, North Carolina, which is still part of the South, in there, not everyone contributes to organic, although there's a huge community of organic farmers there, and basket makers and musicians and acupuncturists and everything dear that we love. Yet next door was a huge silage farm of corn, and they sprayed mercilessly. So how then are the bees to understand not to come and light on my flower in my organic garden, you know, where they decide that they are going to die? So let us not get too caught up in just labels. This is, you know, such a good message. Food is medicine, but that medicine is inside of us. It's in that inner space again that we can keep expanding and opening to what serves the world as well as what serves ourselves, what serves our family. If we can't think of the world, at least our family and our community. That is where food is medicine.
You know, this is profound and it's complex. And yet when you understand, it's simple. So you must have seen thousands of people who come to you with this fear, with confused messages, overload of information about nutrition, and they come to you to learn about food as medicine. Can you give one or two examples by recollecting people that you have seen, how they changed?
Yes. Let's take Sarah's case, for instance. Sarah came to me with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And she was on a typical American diet. She was not vegetarian. She ate, you know, as well. She came from a fairly affluent economic background as well. But she was willing to look at food. She came to one of my courses and was looking to make a radical change in her life, understanding that she chose not to go to chemotherapy and radiation. She had read studies of miracles happening and da-da-da-da, whatever.
So you don't actually suggest to people what treatments they should receive?
Absolutely not. Okay. I meet someone exactly where they're at.
Okay.
If she came to me and said, I need to do chemotherapy, like so many women have done, I would say, fine, let's see how we can augment and support you through Ayurveda with your present protocol. And we do, because we use simple things like Trifla, for instance, if you're on chemotherapy and radiation, to get rid of the toxicity that radiation and chemotherapy can leave in the body.
I think, you know, we need to just talk a little bit about Trifala. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an Ayurvedic doctor, and Trifala has three components. It's Indian gooseberry, and then two other fruits which grow on the foothills of Himalayas and northern parts of India in very tall trees. They are all Embelica family. And they have very high antioxidants and adaptogens, which traditionally have been used just to keep the gut clear, you know, mm-hmm. in the sense, you know, they have a bit of a laxative effect, but mm-hmm. they also have a lot of fiber and phytoconstituents, which help in better digestion and improving one's immunity. And mm-hmm. that's very widely used in the tradition of Ayurveda and also by all Ayurvedic mm-hmm. practitioners. Yeah, it's available as a food supplement.
It's a food supplement, and it's grown in Hawaii in many places now, so it's not just in India. We have, you know, it's good to know that it doesn't have to be just imported. from India because
let's come back to Gooseberry.
But Sarah's treatment really was, she took the course in the food, Ayurveda foods, and stayed about 3 weeks at the school where she was able to do gardening, get her hands in the earth, absolutely see how things grow. It's such a love for people when they first get back to it. Remembered her grandmother's story, and it was her most recent story was of her grandmother gardening. You know, they're of Italian origin, born in Pennsylvania in America, and all of those good things. And really dedicated herself to having a wonderful balance. She was a Pitavata woman. And when we looked at, I knew that it would be her left breast because she had difficulties with her maternal line. The left of our body tend to be lunar, the right solar. Lunar is mother, solar is father. That is simplistic understanding. But she had years-long battle and confrontations with her birth mother. And so you understand from a psychological point of view that she has to heal that relationship. And asked her to stay on in the community, not at the school, but in the community if she wanted to stay on and continue to garden, which she volunteered to do. The other part of it is, you know, we taught her how to cook the brown rice in the winter and then again grains throughout the year, how to make a salad with grains and greens and wonderful things in the summer. And just seasonal, just really sticking with the seasonal, simple meals. And she carried it forward. We did recommend some Ayurveda herbs, very simple, like truffula, just to keep clearing out colon. And also, what was wonderful is the brown rice in her case really, really was, I think, the most important of her food. She kept doing it for a year, and every 3 months went in to get checked up. And by the end of the year, she was free of cancer. Just on food. And it's wonderful, but it wasn't just on the food. It was her changing her relationship to herself. Ayurveda does not look at the symptomatic causes of problems. It goes back to how we respond. It doesn't look at the symptoms, only the cause, but not only causology. It shows us how we are responding to the cause of an illness. Not just the cause of the ill, cause of the illness, Sarah would have said, was our mother. But the cause of her illness was her response to her mother. And she also had a genetic strain of having had it in her maternal line, breast cancer.
So what we're really looking at is, you know, from a more scientific medical perspective, that a condition like cancer is chronic. So it's got genetic predisposition or the genetic factors which can express themselves, but there is also an influence of the environmental factors, which is the lifestyle and the environment. And of course, you know, our psychological responses to stress. And when the genetic factors become stimulated along with risk factors from lifestyle and food, then that completes the sufficient cause for the body to become cancerous.
That's incredible.
So the way we really need to look at cancer is not just cancer as a tumor or the disease as one piece of the pie. If you construct the whole piece of the pie, you're looking at all other pieces of the pie, and some of them actually can be reversed or modified. We're not talking about cancer, but there are, by reducing the risk factors, we are already helping the person to move towards path of health, even in that condition. So Maya, do you suggest that people use Ayurveda or food as medicine alongside conventional therapies for cancer, or would you leave that choice to the person? Or what's your experience? What are your views? I'm not forcing you to actually. It's not a one simple answer. I know, as a practitioner, you can't just say this is what everyone should do.
No, don't. Of course not, because the individual is the individual. We always look at the individual. We don't treat them. I've never looked at a person as a patient. We're all patients. We all lack patience, and we are patients of nature, because we absolutely have something that is not going to stay completely balanced at all times. So I look at the person. I have run a school. I'm an educator, so I'm not a physician. But as people come through the education, they come with diseases, they come with ailments, and I do thousands of conferences. I meet thousands of women and men, and women come to me and said, I have this, what can I do? And sometimes I spend as little as 10 minutes with them and make the shift for them, help them to, you know, shift and engage very quickly what their psychological state would be, what their fears are, and what may be a starting point for them to go on their journey. I can't suggest that there's one protocol for everybody. I meet someone where they're at. If they have faith in allopathic medicine, who am I to take that away from them? If they have faith in holistic medicine, who am I to give a yay to them about that? I absolutely meet someone where they need my help, and however I can help them purposefully, we want to build their faith in themselves, not take away what they have already struggled to build. So that question is complex, but let me put it this way. There's a wonderful woman, Nancy, who came from South Africa. Mm-hmm. Her father had attempted many years earlier to kill himself and commit suicide and ended up with brain damage, but alive. And he was in a medical care facility in South Africa, and she felt very badly. She hadn't seen him for about 7 years, and she carried the guilt of not being able to be there for him. That's a really big disease. Despair is a big disease causing mud field. We know that. And when she came, I noticed she was drumming so beautifully in the chanting classes. She just was an avid drummer, must have picked up that incredible African rhythm. She was white South African, but she must have picked up that incredible beat that's in the land of that exquisite ancient culture. And the girl just did the djembe. I mean, it was very amazing, because we were using tabla and the likes for the Vedic chants. And I thought, okay, why don't you make a tape of your playing the drums and chant with it and send it to your father? Oh, I can't do that because they don't allow any music in the facility. So what on earth kind of facility is this? Music has such a huge way of healing. It's just a sound. Music is nature, sound captured in our different individualized tempo. It is an incredible form of healing, which science have been proving over and over. So I thought it through, and before the end of the course, I said to her, I know what, you love baking. And, you know, those wonderful coconut cookies that we baked at class, why don't you knead and then drum and then knead and drum the drum music into the dough and send your father a package of cookies. Mm-hmm. And she did. And it was so delightful. I think what happened there was it opened her heart to let the guilt flow out. But beyond that, it went to the father, and he just told her how much he missed her, and the cookies were the best thing he had ever had. And the next few months, she went to see him. Mm-hmm. Healing is so subtle. It isn't obvious that we think it is. And that's what Ayurveda teaches us to.
So the way I understand from your explanations and interpretations of food as medicine, it is not about the phytonutrients in the food. So again, we don't want to take that very biomechanical approach of understanding the various chemical components in the food, believing that that's going to fix a condition. When we are holistic, food is holistic, and to develop that relationship, is this what you are talking about?
Absolutely. Maya? Food as medicine is developing the relationship rather than fight our brains, already overloaded brains and minds, with all of the scientific breakdown, which most people cannot comprehend, nor can I. Go and take, instead of 5 hours trying to look through the data of all this breakdown, take 1 hour, take half hour, and go and sit with your feet in the stream and let the running water inform you of what it is you need to do after you get out of the stream, or sit under this huge oak tree and just watch the glistening light come through the leaves and know that you're being fed and filtered all the time by Mother Nature's love. There's so much we can do, but brain fatigue is a huge problem. It's a problem of excess information that makes absolutely no sense to humanity's healing. Food for one must be food for all. And what I mean by that statement is that we cannot be completely happy unless we can contribute to where someone else can also be happy. Someone else can also be fed and nourished. Someone else can also, and if just through prayer that we do that, that consciousness is what keeps us thriving as a human entity. We are human because of the humanitarian aspect that our soul needs to be fed and nourished all the time. And only through the consideration of ourself with self-love and others can we really heal. Mm-hmm. So on that premise alone, it doesn't really shoot down all the things science does, but it just puts us back into the field of the simple, where let's claim little bits at a time and start to feel our way into nature again.
I know that, you know, in your work through Wiser School, that you promote this particular concept of sadhana, which is a Sanskrit word for practicing through total commitment and engagement and developing a relationship with concepts, with food, with nature. So sadhana seems to be the overarching concept of how you use food and your environment to nourish oneself. We'll talk more about that. I mean, in fact, we have spoken a lot about the relationship that we need to develop with food. But in the next episode, where we are going to be looking at the third step, which is not just the creating an inner space, engaging with food, but there is a psycho-emotional cleansing, psycho-emotional nurturing that needs to happen in any illness, particularly in cancer. So there, I'm going to be talking to Maya about the role of fasting. Fasting, not just for fat loss, which I do a lot, but fasting for cleansing and detoxification by understanding our relationship with nature, the lunar cycles. For people who like to know more about your approach towards food and nourishment and inner medicine, where can they go? Is there a book that you would recommend, Maya?
Yes, my second book, actually, and the first was on, or it was work I did with Aveline Cushy, who was the champion of the macrobiotic movement in America, and I did the Ayurveda section of her book, which is called Diet for Natural Beauty. But the second book, the first of my Ayurveda books, Ayurveda, A Life of Balance, mm-hmm. by Maya Tiwari. That book is in print in about 12 different languages, and so it can be had at Amazon and many other booksellers. That tells a very clear picture of our Ayurveda anatomy. It gives us our understanding of nature, seasons, etc., etc. It's a wonderful tome.
So fantastic. So we can learn more about Maya Tiwari's approach to health and healing by visiting her website, mayatiwari.org, mayatiwari.org, or you can visit wiseearth.com, wise as in wise, earth as in earth.com. There are two E's. Thank you so much, Maya.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Sukhinaha